sign a density in Carolina in the morning.
In Carolina.
No one could be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you'll hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading excerpts from Whitaker's Reminiscences, Incidents, and Anecdotes, Recollections of Other Days and Years, or What I Saw and Heard and Thought of People Whom I Knew and What They Did and Said, by Reverend R. H. Whitaker, D.D., Raleigh, North Carolina. Besides being a Methodist minister, Reverend Whitaker was also editor of a Raleigh newspaper. This book was published in 1905. Chapter 32, Rural Deliveries, Old-Time Mail Route, Spanking a Yankee. Rural free deliveries are wonderful improvements upon the old-time star routes, when a fellow on horseback carrying a pair of saddlebags went a journey of 100 miles, more or less, to supply a sparsely settled country with a few letters and still fewer newspapers. In my young days, my father had a contract for carrying the mail from Raleigh to Johnsonville in Cumberland County, a post office west of Fayetteville, and, for a few months, this writer enjoyed the privilege and, for a while, the pleasure of being a mail carrier. To give the reader an idea of the insignificance of the mail service of that day, as compared with the advantages people now enjoy, I will write up a trip that had to be made once a week. And to begin, I must state that my father lived 12 miles south of Raleigh, and as this was the starting point, we usually came here on Thursday evening to be ready, as the contract required, to start with the mail early Friday morning. As we had a post office, Middle Creek, at our home, the rider would reach there for breakfast. Then he would start for Holly Springs, which place he would pass about 11 a.m., where he would give his horse a bundle of fodder and a few ears of corn, and eat his lunch, consisting of biscuits and fried chicken or ham. Leaving Holly Springs, he would go westward. Passing the Bookers, the Booths, and the Collins, he would finally fall into the Raleigh and Haywood Road, and, crossing Hall River, he would deliver mail to the Haywood office. By then, it was growing late in the day. Leaving Haywood and crossing Deep River on the Haywood and Fayetteville Road, he would go about 6 or 7 miles to Mr. John McLeod's and spend the night. He was the grandfather of Mr. John T. Pullen of this city, as well as of Mrs. C. H. Belvin and Mrs. L. W. Crawford. Saturday morning, bright and early, the rider would be on his way to Rollins' store in Moore County, a few miles east of where Jonesboro is located. There he fed and got breakfast. From Rollins' store he went a southwest direction through the piney woods, most of the time traveling a mere trail of a path, flushing every now and then large flocks of wild turkeys, and not infrequently jumping a deer, to Johnsonville Post Office, of which Mr. John W. Cameron was postmaster. There he fed and took dinner. Mr. Cameron, I remember, was very careful in arranging his mail matter. For instance, I have frequently seen him, after folding a letter and sealing it with a wafer, take a flat iron and smooth it. Envelopes were not much used in those days. After dinner, the rider went in a northwest direction to Pocket Post Office in Moore County, of which Daniel McIntosh was postmaster. There he found a good supper and a nice bed to sleep on, and generally felt very much like eating and sleeping after making such a long ride. Sunday morning, coming east, he would pass Buffalo Presbyterian Church, and also where Jonesboro now stands, and take breakfast at John Shepherd's Longstreet Post Office. After breakfast, he would come on and cross Cape Fear River at Avent's Ferry, and, coming through the Buckhorn Country, leaving Holly Springs to the north and Piney Grove to the south, would reach home that Sunday evening. Monday morning, he would come to Raleigh and deliver his mailbag to old Postmaster White at the post office, which stood somewhere near where the Tucker Building stands now. What a journey was that to supply only 7 offices! And to think that a pair of saddlebags would carry all the mail matter that went into all that country seems almost incredible when we see the many bags that go out daily on the trains, filled with papers and letters, into the same territory now. How things have changed since I used to ride the mail, especially in the country I then traversed. In the first place, a railroad runs through my father's old plantation, where Middle Creek Post Office was, and a railroad runs to Holly Springs, and a railroad runs to Haywood, and one runs to Jonesboro, not far from Rollins' store and pocket, and one runs not far from Johnsonville, all of which have been built since that time. And in the second place, the old people have died, and their children have taken their places, and schools and villages and even towns have sprung up, so that where the old field log schoolhouse stood, an academy now stands, and instead of the little hamlet with a few unpainted dwellings, a town has sprung up, and is quite as large as Raleigh was when I was a boy. The country, by the way, will soon be all town, or at least will enjoy town facilities. With good telephone lines and an abundance of churches, the country will ere long be as much in town as it need be, so far as real enjoyments are concerned. If I were a young man and my ambition was to live long and be happy, I certainly should try to locate in the country, as things are now. For, by the time one pays town taxes and the high prices for such things as he would like to have, and would have if he lived on a farm, he has paid pretty dearly for the privilege of living on a quarter-acre lot in town. Town privileges, like spring chickens, cost more than they're worth, unless a man has a railroad job with a good salary. Speaking of Johnsonville Post Office reminds me to say that when Sherman's army was approaching Fayetteville, Kilpatrick camped near that old-time post office the night before the army entered Fayetteville, and although he must have been very tired, and although it was said he had a lady in his tent, General Joe Wheeler's cavalry had the audacity and the ill manners to make a dash into his camp in the dead of night and run him and his lady friend out in their night clothes, thereby making a scandal that had quite a run about the winding up of the war. Wheeler's cavalry gave Sherman's army much trouble, for, like Stonewall Jackson's foot cavalry, they turned up at the most unexpected times and places, and made a sensation wherever they appeared. I was a refugee when the Yankees came to Raleigh, or at least I was en route through the country for Charlotte, as it was supposed, when Richmond fell, that Charlotte would be made the temporary abode of President Davis and his cabinet. Colonel D.K. McRae, the editor of the Daily Confederate, informed me that the press and fixtures of that paper would be carried to Charlotte, and told me, as well as other members of the staff, to go on there and be ready to commence publication as soon as the office material could be put in shape. After hauling all my corn, wheat, oats, fodder, peas, hay, etc., to Raleigh and delivering them to the Confederate authorities for the use of the army, taking receipts which promised to pay back in kind after the Yankees had passed by, I loaded my wagons and, with my family, started through the country to Charlotte. On the second evening, I camped about 15 miles west of Fayetteville, near a Mrs. Monroe's, where the Yankees had recently been. A Mrs. McDougald, daughter of Mrs. Monroe, entertained and amused wife and me, telling her experience with the Yankees. The people of Fayetteville had sent a cheese box full of watches and jewelry to her for safekeeping, and by some means the Yankees found it out, and they worried her no little trying to make her tell them where the box was hid. She told us of a Yankee, of rather small stature and light weight, who was very insolent, ordering her to get up from her seat in very rough language. "It made me so mad," said she. "I caught hold of him as he stood near me, jerked him across my lap and spanked him well, and then rolled him on the floor at my feet. He jumped up as soon as he could and threatened to shoot me, but the other Yankees who saw me spank him, and were almost dying a laughing at him, told him if he didn't shut up and behave himself that they would whip him sure enough." "No," said she, "they didn't find that box, but thousands of Yankees walked over it. One fella thought he would make me betray myself by coming in and saying, 'We've found it,' thinking I'd look in the direction of where it was hid, but I didn't. I simply said, 'If you found it, all right, but I didn't tell you where it was, did I?' He was telling a lie, and I knew it." Before reaching Mrs. Monroe's that evening, I met Major Wright Husk, who had been stationed at Camp Holmes, just north of this city, and, to my astonishment and consternation, he informed me that General Lee had surrendered. The war was over, and the Confederate government was a thing of the past, and that I need not go another mile toward Charlotte in the expectation of meeting Colonel McRae there, that the Daily Confederate, like the Confederate States, was a thing of the past. I never felt so poor in all my life. Though I had thousands of dollars of Confederate money in my pocket, I was not able to buy one feed for my teams. Next morning, leaving my wagons and teams at Mrs. Monroe's, my wife and I drove down to Fayetteville to get the straight of the matter. I was not personally acquainted with E.J. Hale, Esquire, the editor of the Observer, but as he and my father were boys together in the office of the old Raleigh Register in the days of Joseph Gales, about the time of the War of 1812-13, and as they were still friends, I felt that I would like to get his opinion as to the situation and his advice as to my movements. He confirmed the statement of Major Husk and advised me not to go any farther toward Charlotte, but let my teams remain where they were for a few days and then move them down toward Fayetteville. That was on Saturday evening. Sunday I spent in Fayetteville with Mr. Thomas Pickett, my wife's uncle, a refugee from near Wilmington. Monday morning, to my astonishment, I saw my brother-in-law, Mr. Richard Kuntz, driving into town and reporting that the Yankees in a large body, with a great many wagons, had crossed the Cape Fear at McNeil's Ferry and seemed to be headed toward Charlotte. I had parted with Mr. Kuntz near Lillington, he expecting to return home as soon as the Yankees had passed Raleigh, while I expected to go on to Charlotte. The report he brought was stunning, because I knew that my teams and all the valuables I had, including about 1,500 pounds of bacon, were on the road the Yankees were said to be marching. I drove as rapidly as I could toward Mrs. Monroe's, feeling my way very carefully, however, the nearer I got to where I left my teams. When I finally reached them, I found all there, drivers as well as the teams, but learned that a large body of Yankee prisoners, in the hands of Wheeler's cavalry, did pass that place on the day before, Sunday, and the wagons were loaded with provisions, which Wheeler's men were distributing freely to the people. And Mrs. McDougald informed me that one of the prisoners was no other than the little fellow that she took across her lap and spanked. I soon moved my teams down to Fayetteville, crossed the Cape Fear, and, following the two armies, came on up to Smith's Battlefield, near Averysboro, and, hearing that Sherman's army was still in and around Raleigh, I recrossed the Cape Fear, rented land from Mr. John C. Williams, and pitched a crop. I had plenty of horses, and for a few days plenty of hands, but, hearing that the war was over and they were free, they dropped out, one or two each night, until they all went. But before they went, I had broken up and planted enough river land to make 100 barrels of corn. I managed to have it plowed one time, sowing down peas when the corn was hardly knee-high, and that was the last of it. Corn, peas, and weeds had a tight race, but the corn and peas I raised brought me in a nice roll of greenbacks. Next fall, after disposing of my crop, I came home, bringing all the watches, jewelry, and silverware, which the Yankees knew I had, but, as they didn't know where to find me, they failed to get. I have had right much to say about myself, but it's all history, and the events referred to were very real in their day and time. I want to say, before closing this sketch, that no refugee in the days of the breakup had a better time than I. As neighbors, I had the Williamses, McNeils, Smiths, Elliots, Harrises, Parkers, Hodges, and Searleses, all of whom were more than kind, and although the Yankees had passed through that country, these good people had plenty to live upon and to divide with the refugee. And while I had no money, I could buy anything I needed with bacon, of which I had more than plenty after my Negroes left me. With a hatchet, saw, and an auger, I made a first-class sofa out of fence rails and upholstered it with wheat straw and one of my wife's old homespun dresses made of Confederate silk. It was both useful and ornamental, and we were proud of it. The neighbors loaned us some bedsteads and chairs, and having plenty of feather beds which we carried from home, our house, though not elegantly, was, we thought, very comfortably furnished. We had no spring chickens, but the squirrels came in troops from the river low ground up to the grove surrounding our house so that I could sit on my porch before breakfast and kill enough to feed us for a day. It was almost like the coming of quails into the camp of Israel. We had many rare experiences while refugeeing, but in the main we had a good time. Mrs. W. P. Oldham of Wilmington, my wife's cousin, who was then a happy-hearted girl, making everything cheerful and bright around her, will, if she reads this sketch, recall many incidents connected with those days, which will doubtless provoke old-time hearty laughter. Oh, how delightful to sit and think of the young life, the happy days before cares and troubles beclouded our sky.
Hear the rolling of the drums, Dolly Gray. Back from war the regiment comes, Dolly Gray. On your lovely face so fair, I can see a look of care. For your soldier boy's not fair, Dolly Gray. For the one you love so well, Dolly Gray. In the midst of battle fell, Dolly Gray. With his face towards the foe, as he died he murmured low, I must say goodbye and go, Dolly Gray.
Goodbye, Dolly.
Chapter 34. First Legislature Under an Oak, About Dogs and Other Dogs. In Grandfather's Tales, Colonel Creasy tells us, on the authority of General Duncan MacDonald of Edenton, that the first General Assembly of North Carolina was held under a large oak in Pasquotank County, and that one of the rules governing that body was that the members should wear shoes during the sessions thereof, and that they should not throw their chicken and other bones under the tree. We cannot see for the life of us why that assembly required its members to put on shoes while in session, unless it was to impress the common people with the dignity of that body. But it is easy to understand why chicken bones were not allowed to be thrown down under the oak. It was doubtless to keep the dogs from prowling around after those bones and fighting over them while the assembly was engaged in legislative work. And we are bound to admit that the members of that assembly were wise in their day and generation, for they knew that dogs were dogs, and that dogs, by instinct, habit, and common deportment, were not fit to be allowed in public meetings. Hence, when the legislators ate their lunches of chickens, backbones, and hog jowls, they were required by law to throw the bones outside the legislative circle covered by the big oak. Supposing that each member had a dog, we can imagine the scene around when the bones were thrown out, the many fights which occurred among the dogs, for dogs like men will fight over bones, and the much bad feeling engendered when a member with shoes on kicked another member's dog. Some people have a way of carrying dogs to church, and yet it is very well known that dogs have not improved in manners since the days of old Jezebel. Some of the most annoying, as well as some of the most ludicrous scenes in churches have been occasioned by dogs. In my young days, I used to attend preaching at Old Pleasant Springs, about 8 miles south of Raleigh. The Christian denomination worshipped there, and Reverend Anthony Franks was the pastor. The Sunday of which I am writing was the communion occasion, and the basket which contained the bread and wine sat on the floor in front of the pulpit. While Mr. Franks was preaching, the children over on the mother's side of the church were eating biscuits and dropping the crumbs, and about a half dozen dogs of various sizes, colors, and classes were pushing and crawling under benches and the women's dresses, trying to get the crumbs, and the whole biscuits as well that occasionally were dropped by fidgety children. I noticed one dog especially that seemed to be not only very active in crumb hunting, but had a ferocious air about him and would growl at the children now and then. At length he found the basket, which contained the sacramental bread, and into it his nose went. And, but for the timely interference of a member who sat nearby, he soon would have devoured it. The sermon ended, the communion followed, the white members coming first, then came the colored people, and among them old Aunt Prissy Banks, who thought shouting was always in order when people took the communion, and she had as much right as anybody, so she shouted. But no sooner did she break out than did that dog, with a ferocious look, begin to bark. At first she did not seem to notice him, but she soon discovered that he was barking at her, for, turn which way she might, he was in front of her, barking as if he had treed a raccoon. She quieted down long enough to leave the house, but as soon as she touched the ground, and thinking the dog was still in the church, she began to shout again. In a moment the dog was there, and, if possible, barking more fiercely than he did in the house. For fully 5 minutes it was shouting and barking, and barking and shouting. Aunt Prissy would say, "Glory to God, go away from here! Glory to God, go away from here!" But the dog wouldn't go. He continued to bark until some of the colored sisters told Aunt Prissy she'd better stop, and she did, saying by the way of a wind-up, "Thank the Lord they ain't got no dogs in heaven. They all goes to the other place, and I wish that dog was there right now." As I'm about it, I will give the reader some other instances of the bad behavior of dogs, as well as two or three of their good behavior. For, be it known and remembered, that dogs are not all alike, any more than folks. Therefore, they don't all behave well in church. Some folks behave, and some do not. Just so with dogs. Reverend William I. Langdon was preaching at the Methodist Church on Federal Point, about 1850, when a bench-legged fice, the property of one of the members of that church, made himself very conspicuous. He would run to the door and bark, then he'd run to his master, then go round among the boys who would pet him, and in various and numerous ways he managed to disturb the preacher while he amused the children. At last he went to the pulpit, hopped up on the bench, and began to lap water out of the preacher's pitcher. The preacher took in the situation, and, thinking he had a right to the pulpit, and that the dog was an intruder, he kicked him out. He went out howling, and the master, and all the family to whom the dog belonged, went out with him. And such was the disturbance outside, the preacher had to stop, and the church came nigh being broke up. The people were divided upon the matter. Some of them said the preacher was not to blame, that the dog had no business in the pulpit drinking out of the preacher's pitcher, while others thought that dogs ought to be allowed to do as, and go where, they pleased, so they did not bite people. It took the church a long time to recover from that dog affair. Way back in the 40s, there was a church in Chatham County which had been so rent by dissension among its members as to be left off the circuit. Consequently, it had no preaching. A brother Postel, I think it was, then living in Pittsburgh, concluded in the early summer that he would go out and preach to those people and try to harmonize the discordant elements. He took Brother Hanks, an old-time Sankey, with him to lead the singing, and went prepared to say a great many things about brotherly love, and especially loving thy neighbor, taking for his text, "Who is my neighbor?" Three things happened that tended to break the force of his very appropriate sermon. In the first place, just as he commenced, he happened to look out, and he saw that a yearling had found his saddle and was chewing the girth, as he had taken it off his horse and hung it on a low limb to let his horse cool off. It was a borrowed saddle, and he had to hurry out after it. He returned and was getting fairly under way again when there was a general breaking loose of horses, caused by one horse pawing up a yellow jacket's nest, and he, breaking loose, covered with yellow jackets and running among the other horses, scattered the stingers as he went, caused nearly every horse, and the preachers with the rest, to break loose. And such running and kicking were never before witnessed in Chatham County. After a long while, the horses were caught and order restored. The preacher said, upon resuming, "Brethren, I came out here to preach, and although it does look like the devil is against me, I am determined to finish up before I quit." And for a while he went on as if he would go through sure enough, but a great big dog came to the door, and, planting his 4 feet on the top step, growled as he saw another big dog lying in front of the pulpit. That dog raised up on his 4 feet and growled back. The dog outside came in and growled again. The pulpit dog got up on all his feet and growled back. It was not a moment before they literally took the church. Men, women, and children went through the windows as if the house had been on fire, and not until somebody threw a bucket of water on them did they stop fighting. No, I don't blame the First North Carolina Assembly for making a law against throwing chicken and other bones down under their oak. I have to admit also that all church-going dogs do not misbehave, as the following story, which I heard a Methodist preacher tell, will demonstrate. In a certain town, a preacher said, there was a dog that for several years went regularly with the children of a Presbyterian family to Sunday school, would go into the church quietly and orderly, take his place under the pew on which the home children sat, and keep perfectly quiet until the doxology was being sung, when he would come out and stand in the aisle to be ready to march out with the children when school closed. His good behavior must, of course, be attributed to the fact that he was a Presbyterian dog. He not only went to the Sunday school, but was a regular attendant on church services, and went, whether any of the family did or not, always occupying the same place, and always remaining until the doxology was sung. But a strange thing happened. On a certain occasion, a Methodist bishop went to that town and preached in the Methodist church, and the Presbyterian family who owned the dog went to the Methodist church to hear the bishop, and so did the dog. He followed his master into the church and hid himself under the seat where he could hear the whole of the service, especially the bishop's sermon. As on other occasions, he stood up during the doxology and went quietly out and to his home after the benediction. From that day, he quit going to the Presbyterian Church, but became a regular attendee at the Methodist Church. The preacher who told this story was undecided in his mind what it was that caused the dog to leave the Presbyterian and join the Methodist Church, but supposed he fell in love with the Methodist doctrine, that being the first time he had ever heard a Methodist preach. I don't vouch for this story, if a Methodist preacher did tell it, but must say that was a very remarkable dog. Now here's the story of a dog that was not only well-behaved, but said his prayers, which is more than some people do, who think they're better than dogs. Besides, he had sense enough and honesty enough to deal justly between man and man. He was a good dog, and, no doubt, behaved in church. Every preacher of the North Carolina Conference used to know Reverend Moses J. Hunt, and in Warren, Granville, Franklin, Wake, and Nash, wherein his ministerial labors were more abundant, his name was a household word. He was an old-time revivalist, and never was more in his element than when holding a meeting, and no man could beat him singing "The Old Ship of Zion." Thousands of souls were converted under his ministry, and wherever he has labored, the good people love his memory. In short, Moses J. Hunt was a good man. He was also a good hunter, as well as fond of fishing. He had a bird dog that went with him, stayed by him, and learned of him, and in many ways manifested more than ordinary dog intelligence. On one occasion, Brother Hunt and Brother Purnell, a Baptist preacher, went fishing together, Brother Hunt's dog following. They found a hole in the creek where the fish bit rapidly, and for some time they caught and threw the fish behind, almost as fast as they could take them from their hooks. After a while, they concluded to string their fish, when lo, on turning about, they saw not a single one. They were astonished, and could not imagine how all their fish had so mysteriously disappeared. Brother Hunt, seeing his dog some 25 yards away sitting on his haunches, asked, "Ponto, where are our fish?" Ponto cut his eyes right and left and wagged his tail, as much as to say, "Here they are." They went to Ponto, and there lay two piles of fish, the Hunt catches in one pile, and the Purnell catches in another pile, while Ponto stood between. That's the way I heard the story, coming from two preachers. I did hear that Ponto learned to imitate his master in saying his prayers, that before he laid down, he would put his forefeet upon a chair, drop his head down, piously close his eyes, and remain in that position about as long as he had seen his master pray. I tell that as a hearsay, not vouching for the truth of it. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.